And I'd like now to welcome to the program Tony Angel. He is illustrator and co-author, along with wildlife scientist John Marsloff, of the book Gifts of the Crow: How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So this is an extraordinary book. It is so much fun to read. It's illustrated beautifully with your nice drawings. And there was so much in it that I didn't know. I'm going to refer to page 2 of the book when you talk about crows and you say, not only do they make tools, but they understand cause and effect. They use their wisdom to infer, discriminate, test, learn, remember, foresee, mourn, warn of impending doom, recognize people, seek revenge, lure or stampede other birds to their death, quaff coffee and beer, turn on lights to stay warm or expose danger, speak, steal, deceive, gift, windsurf, play with cats, and team up to satisfy their appetite for diverse foods, whether soft cheese from a can or a meal of dead seal. Now, these birds are far more like what we might think of as really intelligent primates than birds. First of all, how did you start studying these animals?
Well, both John and I have had a lifetime interest in corvids, which include the ravens, the crows, magpies, and jays, and a few other relatives. They're all members of the songbird family. And when we started to single out our observations on the corvids, particularly crows and ravens, we realized that a lot was going on that just simply didn't go on in the lives of other birds. And I would also suggest that a number of other people were observing these matters in ravens and crows. And so we've collaborated over the last 10, 15 years to focus on what you pointed out just a moment ago, I think is very correct. If anything, the crows and ravens are essentially the primates of the family of birds, like we're the primates of the family of mammals, the most highly evolved and developed and sophisticated, particularly when we started to look at the brain of the bird that allows them to do all of these remarkable things. As an artist, I was fascinated with the potential to portray these birds, even though many of them are of a single color. They have all kinds of remarkable postures and displays, and they're just beautiful form to design in sculpture and in line. So when John and I started working together, this is our third book we've done on corvids, we've integrated not only a narrative but an illustrated side that puts together the larger picture of what these birds can do, and this book certainly is indicative of a much closer look at how similar their behavior is to human behavior.
To what extent did crows co-evolve with humans? In other words, to what extent are human societies instrumental in the way crows live and behave and actually exist genetically?
Well, I think that's a very key question. We argued, I think, pretty convincingly that crows and ravens have co-evolved with people for hundreds of thousands of years. The fossil record indicates that the crows and ravens were part of the encampments and the settlements of people throughout the northern hemispheres around the world. And that co-evolution selected for birds that would, in fact, take advantage of what people do. Each new generation of crows and ravens was selecting for that member of the next generation that could exploit the resources of people, could in fact outsmart them. You think of the way in turn people then have incorporated crows and raven terms into the human language. It's also a indication of how much respect people had for them. So whether you're talking about the scarecrow phenomena, which is really thousands of years old, where they would the agrarian people would put out actually young boys to begin with, a scare boy, but the young boys tended to wander off and do something else, so they would construct scarecrows, and then you think of the crow's nest in a ship, people with crow's feet on their face indicating age, tools like crowbars, on and on and on. The language is just filled with references to crows and ravens.
What are their brains like that make them, I mean, not to get too much into physiology that people might not be familiar with, but basically, on a basic level, what are their brains like that make them so much smarter than just other birds?
Well, for one thing, crows and ravens, along with the parrots, have the largest brains of all the birds. And in fact, the human brain represents probably about 1% of all of our weight, and slightly over that, perhaps in the case of the New Caledonian crow, their brain represents 1.9% of their overall weight. So just on the ratio of brain size to body size, the New Caledonian crow is an Einstein among animals. And when we started to look at the brains of these birds, we discovered that there has been a lot of current research on the neurobiological side of crows and ravens, showing the similarities between our brain and those of birds, but particularly crows and ravens, even though, because of the separation in evolutionary time, our brain took one direction in its formation. The bird's brain took another direction, and while it looks different, it has all the essential parts that our brain has. And one of the great misnomers of the last 120 years was when a physiologist looked at the bird brain and said, oh, it doesn't look like our brain at all, so they must really be creatures of instinct. We'll call those creatures of instinct bird brains. And that term stuck around for over 100 years, and now you call somebody a bird brain, you're actually paying them a compliment. And that great big frontal lobe, which we could call the executive decision-making section of the crow's brain, brings in all kinds of information. Of course, they have all the essential sensory apparatus that we do. And they not only react to the moment, but they circulate that information through the brain to make very refined decisions based on previous experience. They have great memories, as we discovered, for all kinds of things. We might touch on that a little bit later. But so you're getting a very sophisticated response from this bird, not unlike you'd get from a human who has a memory of an experience, refines that experience with more information, and then renders a decision that is based on that experience and usually makes a good one. You watch crows react around picnic tables. They size up the people having lunch. They forage along roadside and step out of the way nonchalantly because they understand how fast cars are coming. They don't panic, and then they go back to feed on something alongside the road. You watch them size up people who walk across the field, and if they don't have a gun, they stay in the tree, but they sure know it when they do have a gun, and so on and so forth.
Now, their memories are sometimes better than those of the graduate students whom they're working with.
Very good. Yeah, right down in the Southwest, where John, my co-author, took his PhD in Arizona, they did studies on the nutcrackers and pinyon jays, which, by the way, are responsible for reforesting much of the Southwest after wildfires because they cache seeds down there and the trees grow. But when they did the test to see how the grad students would remember where the seeds were cached and compared it with what the jays were doing, these were captive jays, the graduate students really didn't even come close. Their memories were not nearly as complex. It's the hippocampus that's responsible for the memory. And matter of fact, the hippocampus grows during the period of time when they're caching the seeds and then shrinks after they have retrieved the seed when that memory is no longer relevant. And that's both in nutcrackers and pinyon jays. And you think of those nutcrackers in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and the pinyon jays around Santa Fe. Those birds are very, very keen recollectors, if you will, of where food has been cached. And in the case of the nutcracker, they've been observed retrieving seeds from over 3 feet of snow on the ground. And that means they have to dig through the snow at an angle to find that cache of seeds in the ground that they had put in before the snows fell.
We're talking to Tony Angel, who is co-author of the book Gifts of the Crow. Crows seem to be not only tool users, but quite sophisticated tool makers. I was blown away by one of the stories of basically a crow taking a piece of metal and with its beak fashioning it into a hook where it could get food out of a cylinder. I mean, this is not something that we expect birds or almost anybody but human beings to really do.
This is Betty, the New Caledonian crow that I referred to earlier with the very, very large brain. Betty was pretty famous, and on YouTube video that was posted a few years ago showing this kind of behavior where she was put in a lab. She was a wild-caught crow. She knew how to use tools in the wild. In that case, it would be stems that she would probe with and pry with and so on. And when she grabbed the wire, she stuck it down into the cylinder, and then, as we might try to do, try to stab it and pull it up. That didn't work. Then she tried to use friction against a tiny little bucket down in the bottom of the tube. And the friction along the side of the tube wouldn't pull it up either, using the wire. Pulled out the wire, and within seconds, she had taken that wire, stuck it down under the mounting section where the tube was, and bent it into that hook, dropped the hook down there, hooked the bucket, and pulled it out. I mean, I have to admit, I would have taken me a little bit of time to figure out, what am I going to do with this straight wire? And it took Betty no time at all to do the bending and retrieve the bucket. This is the same bird, by the way, that also, the same species, has manufactured tools, if you will, four or five different kinds of tools to retrieve four or five different sources of food in the jungles of New Caledonia. And she will store, or the birds will store the food, store the tools, and then retrieve them later when they have a particular task to use, like we might put a gardening tool in the garden shed if we want to rake or hoe or something. They grab the right tool for the right job and then put it to work and then cache the tool later. In another experiment we describe in the book, the New Caledonian crow not only will use the tool to get food, but the application of insight is very apparent when the testing arrangement required that the crow use one tool, first of all, retrieve that tool on a string, to get another tool that would be long enough to get the food. So it was actually several steps removed in order to retrieve the food.
It's amazing. I mean, these are animals that, as you say, they understand past, present, and future. They understand cause and effect. And I think, I mean, it seems to me that one of the things that's happening in science is that many of the supposed boundaries between human beings and all other species are being challenged and are being really worn away. And so the idea that all these other animals are instinctual beings as opposed to aware and thoughtful beings. I mean, you've got these crows who are basically using tools, making plans, and they're also really having fun while they're doing it. You've got a whole chapter on what you call frolic.
Well, I think, again, the title of our book, as a metaphor, if you will, the gifts of the crow include showing us a lot of things about nature and about other species that are very highly evolved. They're demonstrating what you've just described, these capacities for doing all kinds of things that we have historically reserved for humans. They share in what certainly are matters of emotion ranging from anger to delight and pleasure, just like we do. They have the same hormones that we do coursing through their bodies. Endorphins flood through their system when they're playing and having fun. And, of course, there's all kinds of games that they engage in. We've got that was fun for me to illustrate, to show some of the things they do. And
right.
Up north of you a little bit in Colorado, ravens have been observed windsurfing, retrieving bark from the ground and then holding it in their toes, like a surfer might get on a board using a wave. In the raven and crow situation, however, it's only 8 toes, not 10. But they hold it, and then they will rise up on a thermal and then let the wind push the board, if you will, a piece of bark, up and down through the wind and sliding over to one direction or the other, and just holding their wings in just a general guiding position, all using the wind as a means of movement.
They play tug of war. They play, what was it? So there was warm air coming out of a chimney or smokestack or something, and they played with the air currents. They've got all sorts of games.
Well, you know, this air current situation is just a couple of blocks from my home up here in Washington. My daughter, Lark, and I were driving back from the university, and it was actually a winter day, early winter day, but it was warm, and a water tower, the top of a water tower, had heated up in the sunlight and created a mini thermal. So you had this warm air, and I said, well, what are all those crows are headed for their roost, which is around 4:30. They go over our house up here to go to a roost, thousands of them. And a lot of them were breaking away from the line of crows headed for the roost and going down to that little thermal above the water tower and playing in the thermal, tumbling, rolling back and forth, opening their wings and parachuting back down into the thermal and then getting shot right up into the air again, you know, like we might do in a water spout or something. But they were clearly having a great time, and after a while they would break away and then join the stream of crows headed for the roost. I might also add the fact that crows and ravens not only play among themselves, like the ravens that would slide down a hilly, snow-covered slope, and they do that all over the northern hemisphere. They've been observed sledding. But they like to play with other animals. And play is a great way to develop skills. It's a non-threatening, typically, arrangement for a young bird to develop strength and ways of movement and activity and become familiar with its world. But I had a raven for a number of years that was very fond of playing with my husky. And I often wondered, because the husky looked much, you know, like a wolf might, if there was some genetic memory in both the dog and the raven, because they took to each other with such an interest, and they would play games of tag back and forth up and down our creek up here, and just for the sheer enjoyment of it all.
I think the whole idea of interspecies friendship is endlessly fascinating. It's a little hard to understand, I mean, because even some crows have become friends with cats, which, in terms of if you're going to talk about instinct and genetic memory, would be thought of as predators, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and again, we had after our previous book, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, we got a number of communications from around the world about observations with crows and cats. More often crows and cats than ravens and cats. The young cat and the young crow, it appears, did not have a innate response to one another of fear. And certainly a cat doesn't, but more so just relating as another animal in a playful manner. And of course, cats do refine that eventually to become very effective predators. But in the case of the crow, the cat was growing up with that crow and vice versa, and they pulled the punches. They would, in one case, the crow would walk through a living room, pulling a piece of string that it clearly knew the cat wanted to chase. And it was a great delight to the crow to race through, as crows do. They don't have to fly because they can both hop and run, with that string trailing behind and the cat coming in hot pursuit, not after the crow, but after the string, much like we do. And then I don't know that the cat had any reciprocal play invitation to the crow, but that was enough. And both of them probably, or very likely, were experiencing the same kind of endorphin load that we would from a game of play and fun when we enjoy something like that.
We're talking to Tony Angel about his book, Gifts of the Crow. Now, one thing that crows seem to like to do is steal. There's a story in the book about a particular crow named Hitchcock. What was he famous for?
Well, Hitchcock was a legend, and as far as I know, he still is, because ravens may live to be as old as 60 or 70 years in a captive situation, we understand. But Raven Hitchcock up in the North Cascade had been stealing windshield wipers, the rubber portions of the wiper, pulling them off and taking them, dropping them at one point or another. And that mischievous kind of behavior is, again, not unusual. Crows and ravens like to test all kinds of things, whether it's a meerkat's tail, the African mammal being pinched by a big white-necked raven that's in the book, or in this case, the raven taking these windshield wipers to the point where it became hazardous, because of rain up there in the North Cascades, people didn't realize their windshield wiper had been dismantled, would go down the highway, and they wouldn't have wipers. So John Marsloff went up and, hey, he does a lot of trapping and banding of birds. He went up there and trapped Hitchcock, banded Hitchcock, right next to the windshield where he had been in the process of tampering. And that was, you might expect, enough for Hitchcock, being a smart bird, to back off on this habit. It was never really determined why the bird was doing it. It looked like it was sheer mischief and little else. Never found a cache of windshield wipers, didn't find a nest made out of it. It didn't seem to be used in any kind of raven treasure trove that one raven might present to another during courtship. But what we thought might be happening is the ravens will see food inside of a vehicle, and they look for the softest place to enter a vehicle, like around a window. And they had been pulling on edges of some of those windows and actually will go into the cars to get a picnic lunch if they can. And he might have been selecting for that windshield wiper simply because it looked like a point of entry. The way that problem was solved, by the way, was they got a little plastic piece of pipe that they each visitor to the North Cascade Park was issued to put over their windshield wipers to protect from any ravens. And Hitchcock is not alone in this habit. Other ravens around the country have been observed pulling on windshield wipers as well.
Who do they, in their natural habitat, what other species do they get along with, and who are their natural enemies, and how do they protect themselves? As you say, they're not nearly as big and strong as, for example, eagles.
Well, you'd probably have to say that crows and ravens don't—they get along with themselves and would consider any other species likely their size either a predator or a threat, and anything smaller, they might be investigating it as a possible meal. But on the other hand, they do nest in a very close proximity to other raptors, and if they're not bothering or mobbing or harassing a hawk on a cliff face and they have a nest not too far away, they get along just fine with one another and just avoid one another. And you can imagine that both of them nesting in proximity, and let's take a prairie falcon, for instance, over in eastern Washington, something I've observed, nesting very close to a ferruginous hawk, which is also nesting close to a raven. They all have their nests along the cliff face. They eat different things, so they're not competing, but they all benefit from the possibility that a coyote might be marauding their family. And the raven will, of course, pursue the coyote, the ferruginous hawk, likewise, and a prairie falcon is going to protect its nest. So they would benefit from one another and tolerate one another. But I'd have to say that crows and ravens probably get along with people better than other species.
It's really striking, their relationship to people, because after reading this book, I thought, you know, they notice us a whole lot more than we notice them. I mean, we co-evolved with dogs and, to a lesser extent, but also for millennia with cats, and those animals have become domesticated, and we've domesticated goats and cows and things like that. But we haven't, for the most part, really domesticated crows, and yet it's almost like they've domesticated us. They've figured out what we can do for them. Like, even one of the examples that I thought was amazing was putting seeds with shells that were too hard to crack on highways, letting them be run over, and then getting the seed in from the inside of the shell.
Yeah, that's something that they leverage wherever they can to their advantage. Some of our behavior and some of our machinery, in the case of the automobiles, this is observations in Japan where the English walnut had been imported, and over a period of time, the crows had learned how to place the walnuts out on the roadway when the light was red and the cars were halted, and then hop back over to the curbside when the light was green. Of course, the cars would come through and run over the nut, and then they'd wait for the next red light to hop out and eat the nut meat. They have clearly been the beneficiaries of our largesse, if you will. You see people feeding crows on a regular basis around Seattle, and more in the urban setting. But they present an opportunity for association and friendship to people, and then people are known by the crows and actually followed by the crows, because crows don't forget faces. And my co-author John Marsloff learned that very, very well with his ongoing study of crows over at the University of Washington campus, where they wore a caveman mask, which is a pretty, you can imagine what that looks like. I've got a drawing in the book. But when they banded the crows they caught, they wanted to see if the birds would remember the face. And that was the experiment itself. And for control, they had other masks, including some very famous people, like they had a Dick Cheney mask. But Dick didn't ban any crows. He just was standing around. They wanted to determine, is it the mask, or do they remember the particulars of the face? Well, make the long story short, within hours, of course, they were back out after the banding, and the crows just went right after them, particularly the ones that had been banded. They were mobbed as they walk across campus with the caveman mask on. If they had another mask on, the crows didn't pay any attention to them because those other masks weren't involved in the banding. Now, 10 years later, guess what? The crows haven't forgotten.
Oh my goodness. Walk out
on the campus, not only do the original crows, the few that are left on the campus, remember the caveman mask, but all the other crows have been taught that the caveman is to be feared. They had no firsthand experience. They weren't even hatched yet, but they had been taught by the other crows that this was someone to fear. And that is a remarkable memory.
That's amazing.
It's stored and pulled forward when they need it.
Now, if a crow is mad at you, is there anything that you can do to get back in its good graces?
I don't know. You know, frankly, if you treat a corvid with hostility, it does take a pretty long time for you to come around to be a good guy again and or a good person. And you don't know whether they're just being cautious or they just don't have the capacity to forgive. But there are some good cases of people who were hostile to crows initially and shook their fist at them, and the crows responded with mobbing, and they flew off to a distance, and then eventually started feeding the birds, and the birds overcame their reluctance to come near, and they have a close relationship with them. And you know the story of the couple in Sweden, do you recall that? That was apparently a very interesting period for a family that had magpies rather than crows. And magpies are, you know, corvids and closely related to crows. But the wife had been hearing her doorbell ring and had gone out on a snowy winter day and saw that magpies were on the fence, but there were no people there. No one had been ringing the doorbell as far as she could tell, and she went back inside and it began ringing again. And when she went out, she realized, she could see through the window, that a magpie had flown over and put its foot down on the lever of the doorbell and was ringing the doorbell to summon the woman out into the yard because she had had some previous experience in feeding the birds. They had learned from watching, apparently, how people would come into the house. They would ring the bell, the door would open, the familiar woman's face would be obvious to the birds, and they had adopted a behavior that would bring her forward, and so she in turn started feeding them, even more so than she had previously. Well, the husband of the family wasn't too keen on it, because as a hunter, he realized that the magpie was a competitor with eating some of the game bird eggs, and the magpie didn't have a great reputation in that part of Sweden. So he went out and essentially cussed the birds out and would shake his fist and probably toss a few things at them to chase them off. And after that, he would drive off to work. Well, what complicated the story was that the wife continued to feed the magpies. And eventually, the magpies took their revenge and made a very interesting discrimination, because one morning when the fellow went out to go to work after shaking his fist at the magpies, he found that the entire windshield of his car was covered with magpie guano. The magpies had essentially bombarded his vehicle in revenge, if you will, to the way they had been treated. The woman's car wasn't touched at all.
Right.
Well, he tried, and they tried to figure that out by changing places with the cars, and it didn't make any difference. They still singled out his and made it difficult to clean off and get to work.
We're talking to Tony Angel, co-author of the book Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. There was even a case where there was a woman who had kind of befriended a crow, and that crow, male crow, kind of developed a crush on her and started doing mating behaviors and bringing her presents and stuff like that.
Well, the literal part of our title, Gifts of the Crow, does deal with that very fact that crows do gift people. And the skepticism that we applied when we started getting these reports was pretty strong. Gifts? How is this possible? And then we started to get so many reports, and we followed them up and ran a series of hypotheses to see if it was credible or not. And more often than not, the credibility of both people reporting and the sequence of events was very strong. And this crow that had a crush could well have been imprinted to a human, and thought of itself as a little bit human and a little bit bird. And it's apparent that the woman was kindly disposed to the crow, and they can read your inclinations by your body language and whether you feed them or you talk to them and what have you. And the crow would bring things, odd things. In one case, a whole series of little medallions and pins and buttons and a prize out of a Captain Crunch box. We investigated one situation over here a little bit north of where we are in Seattle. And this fellow had been feeding crows for, oh gosh, maybe a decade. And over that period of time, he had received a number of gifts. And we went out to take a look at his setup, and he had a huge feeding tray and would walk out, and not a bird in the sky, and within half a minute, one of the crows would see him, summon by whatever language the crow was using at the moment, the other crows, and then they'd come in and have this great feast of leftovers that that he would provide for them. But he had said to us, he said, you know, one day I went out there and said, hey, I feed you guys all the time. What are you going to do for me? And he looked around at him and then went back in the house. I mean, this is what made it so initially strange, if not, it couldn't be happening. He said he went back in, and when he went out after the feeding frenzy out there to see if there's anything left, he found a little candy heart with love printed on it. It was left by one of the crows. And why and how, I mean, clearly, you know, I'm not going to suggest the crow is leaving a Valentine, but
it looked like it, didn't it?
It certainly did. And it does go along with crows leaving something that has some value to them in keeping the pump primed, if you will, for providing food. That, you know, that's reading in, you know, a number of motivations, but it stands to reason that a crow is not going to do things that would destroy that cornucopia of crow chow. And if anything, it, you know, we speculated that it may have come in there hungry, dropped the candy heart, and fed on what was probably better chow, and then failed to retrieve it. But what we couldn't figure out was, why didn't another crow pick up that heart? I mean, that was certainly edible for a crow. They like that kind of stuff.
Well, there's a number of questions that arise from that, and one of them is language. To what extent do they have language? To what extent do they understand and imitate our language? And to what extent is that language imitation versus cognition?
Well, let's start with the beginning of that question. They certainly have their own range of vocalizations with meaning. And I think we'd be the first to say that we're just beginning to understand all the shades and nuances of those communications. The call of the crow, the call of the raven are distinct from one another. And there are dozens and dozens of different calls, for instance, that the raven has, and they're used in different contexts. And just how we can sit down and determine the particular meaning is still out there ahead for us to figure out. Although I will say this, when Franz Boas, the great anthropologist, did his early work with the Northwest people, he said that the Tlingit, Nkwakutl, and the Haida all had deciphered the raven language and knew what the raven was saying from various calls that would suggest visitors coming, beware, food on the horizon, the fissure in the stream, things such as that. And it was interesting to see how the people who had lived with the raven for thousands of years had been listening to that language and putting meaning to it. But when it comes to cognition, related to the matters of using human terminology. It's one thing to mimic, and it's something else to actually apply that particular word in a context. And I use an example in the book about my raven, macaw, that would use my greeting to the bird as a greeting in turn to me. For example, when I would open the door in the morning for his morning flight, I would say, "Hello, macaw." And within weeks, I could hear him beginning to formulate my greeting as a greeting back to me. It was pretty primitive at first, and by the end of a month or so, he had perfected a "Hello, macaw" to me. And he was using the greeting, because he didn't use it any other time of the day, only in the morning, only in greeting me as an individual, didn't use it with anybody else. So the bird is using a human term in context, and this is a thinking process. He'd refined it in dreams, in recollection, in memory, in practice, and oftentimes you'll hear ravens or crows or jays in the forest sounding like they're singing to themselves, and they probably are, practicing all kinds of vocalizations very quietly in what they call a whisper song. And, you know, they're refining these kinds of vocalizations and in their mind putting them in some particular context. Lots of examples of crows and magpies using human terms in reference to individuals. What's that in a noise that's outside, like someone in the house might say? If it's a bird that's in the house, which is usually problematic when it comes to a corvid, I must say it. Better to have them outside than inside because they're so rambunctious. But magpies and crows do make that application.
There was one story where somebody had a crow that spoke, and he would say, he would give him a treat or whatever and say, "This is for you." And the crow would say, "This is for me," which meant the crow understood pronouns.
Yeah, yeah. It understood the syntax, if you will. This is a raven at the Tower of London. And the raven master was feeding the raven and saying, "This is for you." And he gave the raven some food. And in turn, the raven responded by saying, "This is for me," making the personal association with the offering of food. And, of course, there's that long history of ravens in the Tower of London that our friend Boreas Sachs has accounted for in his book.
The other thing that your book makes me think of, and it's a very rigorously scientifically described set of examples that you give, it's not particularly sentimental, or there's a lot of rigor in it that doesn't let you off with sentimental explanations of things. That said, I felt like as I was reading it, you know, as you say, there were indigenous people who had decoded the Crow language. I feel like in some ways, having read this book, maybe the indigenous people have had it right all along, which is we're in one big family with all the other animals, including crows, and the more we understand each other and respect each other, the better off we are, and the more we see our commonalities, the better off we are.
Well, I think you've put your finger on one of the thematic arguments we make in the book as far as opening our sensory abilities, our ears and eyes among them, to the nature of nature, if you will, and the fact that we have so much to learn from our observation and our association. And the crow is like an emissary, or the raven is an emissary from nature that we have close association with. And the native people, not only here in the Northwest, but clearly in the Southwest as well, have had this company an association with these birds ever since their culture evolved. And because technology, one might argue, did not get between them and nature and satisfy some of their needs, they needed to be attuned to what these birds were doing. In a way, you could say, in a metaphorically formed idea, what they were telling them. And I think most people would see that the double-edged sword, which is a little bit of a cliche about technology, has both advanced us and also cut us off from some of these very critical associations with the world and, you know, with the matters related to and the questions related to global climate change. Nature is the chief communicator when it comes to telling us how the species are responding to these shifts in temperature and weather and what it means for the future. It's telling us what we need to do to get our house in order and plan for these kinds of things. And right. And the crow, being as intelligent and forthright, if you will, and so much in our lives, is a great way for us to connect. And by the way, when I'm saying crow, I'm saying about not only the crow, the American crow, and the fish crow that we have here in North America, but I'm saying all the members of the corvid family,
right.
the jays and the nutcrackers and so on.
And I think any reader of the book will be able to tell that you, as not only an author but an artist, have really fallen in love with these birds because your illustrations are just wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I, having lived with them, if you will, and had that association and developed that respect for them was a great gift to me from them, if you will. And I've designed a lot of forms and sculpture and line and also carved stone, and they've just been terrific subjects. And you know, it's interesting to me as an artist side, on the artist side of my being, to say how you begin to develop a kinship and an appreciation with your subject through the art side that is not necessarily accessible through the science side.
Right.
You begin to look closely and think about the miraculous shape and form and postures and displays that these animals are capable of, and you can't help but, I suppose, make comparisons with our own behavior as primates, as humans, but at the same time, it's distinctly theirs. And it's so purposeful and so tuned to the lives that they lead, you begin to then get caught up willingly into the whole beautiful landscape of ecology and how the species work together, giving and taking, if you will, in the process of life. And so it's been very fortunate for me to take this road.
Tony Angel is an author and illustrator. He's illustrator and co-author with John Marsloff of the book Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. It's a wonderful book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I will keep in mind all those fine questions you raised, and I'm glad you enjoy the book and enjoy the company of crows.
Thank you so much.